This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More than 100,000 people have been massacred in the past 3 weeks in Rwanda. Many Rwandans in jeopardy have been calling my guest Alison Desforges. She's the co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda and consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa on Rwanda and Burundi. She's also a historian specializing in Rwanda and Burundi. This latest wave of political and ethnic violence was touched off April 6th when a plane carrying the presidents of Burundi and Rwanda crashed, killing both presidents. Just a few hours after the crash, Alison Desforges got a phone call from her friend Monique Mujawa Maria, a Rwandan human rights worker. Mujawa Maria heard approaching gunfire and was trapped in her house. She called Desforges in desperation. This began a series of phone calls between them that lasted through the night.
At 4 a.m., she called and said that the presidential guard had arrived in her neighborhood, that they had entered a house, a couple of houses removed from hers. They had taken from that house three people, including a man who worked for her human rights association. She had seen them killed, the three of them executed on the street corner. The bodies were still lying there. An hour later, we were on the phone again, two hours later, and she told me that they were in the house next door to hers, that they had brought out a young man, and they were killing him, and I could hear the rifle fire. Then at 6:20, she said, "They're at my door." I could hear the gunshots. She said, "What can I do?" I had already discussed with her the possibility of trying to find a place to hide. I'd suggested she put on some dark clothes so that she would be less visible if she found a place to hide. She's a person who loves brilliant colors. And I said, "Monique, you got to find something old, dirty, and black and put it on." She also had the inspiration to take off her fingernail polish and cut her nails short so that she could try to pass as an ordinary woman of the countryside instead of a city person. And it was when they were at the door and she started to panic. I said, "Look, let them in, open the door, stay on the line with me, hand the phone over, and I'll try to carry this off." Because Monique had been at the White House. She'd been received by President Clinton last December. That was known in Rwanda. And I thought perhaps this would be one way to impress them enough to leave her alone. Her reaction was, "No, I don't think that would mean anything. I don't think it'll work." And then she asked me, "Please take care of my children." And I said, "Monique, don't hang up." She said, "I don't want you to hear this." And then she hung up.
You think what she didn't want you to hear was what she expected to be her own death?
Right.
So then what happened? She hid.
She ran out in the back, and she hid outside for a while in the bush. And then she came back and climbed into the ceiling and spent 40 hours perched on a very small rafter, not moving, not eating, not drinking, going to the bathroom. As she said later on, she wasn't even sure she breathed during that time. And then after all those hours, she came down, and I had, in the meantime, called and gotten someone who worked at her house on the phone and had discovered she was alive. And then she came down and spoke to me, and we set to work to try to find some way to get her from that house into town. Soon after that, phone lines were cut, and it was no longer possible for me to help her. I had, with the help of colleagues in Canada and in Europe and at the UN, I had secured three channels of escape for her, three possible ways to get out of the country, but I had no way to let her know that information.
How did she get from her house to a place of safety?
She basically bought her life. After several days of hiding, she became convinced that her house was going to be invaded and she was going to be caught by the militia. And here there's an important distinction between the militia, who are much less disciplined bands of killers, and the military itself. And she thought she would have a better chance with soldiers than with the militia, because she herself had been married to a military officer for some 14 years. So she decided to take her risks, and she took a photo album that had pictures both of her marriage and of a number of high-ranking military officers who had at different times been guests in her home, and went out and approached a group of young soldiers who were camped in her backyard and said, "You know, I'm the wife of an important military man. He's off fighting the rebels, and I need you to give me an escort into town."
Of course, the truth is she had left her husband years before.
Right, because he had beaten her unmercifully. But they didn't know that, and she did have the pictures of herself as a smiling bride. So she used that, plus approximately $750 to buy her life, and persuaded one of these young soldiers at that price to drive her into town.
And now she's in the United States speaking for her country?
Right, yes.
Do you know a lot of people from Rwanda and Burundi who weren't as lucky as Monique?
Yes. In Rwanda and Burundi, people exchange name cards. It's a custom that carries over from Europe. And in the last week or so, I've discarded about half of my name cards.
The fighting now is between Hutus and Tutsis.
Wrong.
Okay.
The fighting now is between an extremist group that surrounded President Habyarimana, who are Hutu. And they are attacking and slaughtering members of the opposition, who are both Hutu and Tutsi. And as well, they are carrying on a war against a largely Tutsi force called the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So what you have is two levels of conflict, two kinds of conflict. You have formal military engagements between the RPF and the Rwandan army. And that is producing, I suppose, you know, a certain number of casualties. But that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about 100,000 people dead. The 100,000 people who are dead are civilians, unarmed, defenseless civilians, who are both Hutu and Tutsi. The initial victims, some of the most outstanding, the victims we know best in the first hours of violence, the prime minister, for example, Agathe Uwilimana, the president of the Supreme Court, Mr. Kavuruganda, they were Hutu. And so it was a case of Hutu members of the presidential guard executing Hutu opposition politicians.
So does this fighting have much to do with ethnicity, or is it about political power?
It's about political power. And this is a very, very important point, because often commentators and journalists and even our own policymakers in Washington look at this, and because it's happening on the African continent, they figure it must be different from power struggles in other parts of the world. It must be, quote, tribal. And they automatically stick this label onto it, in part because they don't care enough to really inform themselves, but in part also because it then excuses them from any form of action. They can reason, well, this is a tribal conflict, it's ethnic hatred, it's something which has been since the dawn of time, and they assume, of course, that Africa never changes, right? There is no history on this continent in their eyes, it's an unchanging thing. And since it's always been that way, it will always be that way, and therefore we have no role to play in trying to resolve the situation. On the other hand, if you look at it as it really is, as a struggle for power by a group of extremists who had been in power for 20 years and didn't want to give up the goodies, didn't want to share in a situation of extreme poverty where control of the state is the only game in town, then if you understand this as a political struggle over the control of the state, then you can foresee or begin to envision some kinds of solutions which are practical and which require action on the part of the international community.
What do you think can be done to resolve the conflict now?
Well, we who work in human rights have come to the conclusion, I think, that a lot of our strategies in the past for dealing with oppressive governments have been ineffective. We have often relied on sanctions, asking our own government and other governments to impose sanctions on governments that repress their own citizens. And we found that this is far too clumsy a strategy, and that, in fact, often the people we most wish to target end up benefiting because a black market develops, for example, to get around sanctions, and then these are the guys who control the black market, so they end up profiting from them instead of being punished by them. And in a case like Rwanda, where the catastrophe is overwhelming, of course, something like sanctions is far too remote and again too clumsy to be effective. So what we're trying to do is find a new strategy. And what we are coming to is increasing the realization that there must be accountability. We must insist upon accountability from the people who are themselves personally involved in launching these kinds of massacres. So what we are trying to do is to persuade the world community to call upon those people in responsible positions of power and to put their names before the world community so that they become known as individuals. The reason that, one of the reasons that people are willing to go to such lengths to take control of a state is all the personal benefits and perks that they will get from being in power. You know, being able to land their private jets someplace, being able to take a vacation on the Riviera, being able to send their children to Canada or the United States to study, being able to send their wives to Paris for plastic surgery, whatever. We hope that by putting the names of responsible individuals before the world community now, we will alert them to how difficult it's going to be for them in the future to enjoy any benefits from the kind of slaughter that they're now engaging in.
Have you tried that approach before?
No, this is a new approach. And as a matter of fact, last Friday, the White House issued a press statement calling upon the commander-in-chief of the Rwandan army, Augustin Bizimungu, Colonel Bagosora, Colonel Nkundiye, Captain Simbikangwa, and Colonel Mhiranya, who is the head of the presidential guard, naming them as people who have the power to end the slaughter and asking them to do so immediately. This was, I believe, the first time that the White House has ever taken such a step. We're encouraging our colleagues in Europe to ask their governments to take the same kind of step. And along with this, which is directed at identifying responsible individuals and calling upon them to act responsibly, along with that, we are hoping to get a declaration from our own government and all other potential aid givers, that a declaration that a regime built upon thousands of bodies will never be supported by international assistance. This is crucial because Rwanda has in the past relied very heavily upon international aid, both bilateral aid and aid that comes through multilateral groups like the World Bank and so on. And we hope that by making it clear to these extremists that they have no hope of money for their regime in the future, that they will understand the futility of their action. Now, this may not dissuade them, but we hope that if we can broadcast this widely enough within Rwanda, that it will dissuade moderates who might be on the point of joining them and may even persuade these moderates to begin to act to take control back from the extremists.
My guest is Alison DeForge, a consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian and human rights activist Alison DeForge. You've been working with human rights groups for several years. Why do you think the massacres in Rwanda are so savage? And, I mean, we're talking here about attacks with machetes and spears. We're talking about infants being cut up. It's just really hard to conceive of this. These are not your typical human rights violations.
No. I explain everything and understand nothing, I guess, is what it comes down to. On the one hand, I want to say that killing is killing. And whether with a machete or a gun is a little bit irrelevant. We tend to sometimes get fixated on the gory aspects of these things and to think that it's, quote, more primitive or more horrible because it's done in one fashion than another. From my point of view, it really doesn't matter. But I think it's very important in this context to point out that a great deal of the killing that's being done is not being done by machetes and what's called in French arme blanche, but instead is being done by AK-47s, by repeating rifles, and that in fact there would be far, far fewer victims in this slaughter if the arms-producing nations of Europe, East and West Europe, and Asia, and North America, had not been so successful in selling their arms in this region. We know now that in preparation for these murderous slaughters, Habyarimana and officials in his government distributed firearms free, 30,000 in one commune. And it's because there are those firearms available that the death toll has gone up so rapidly.
Who did the president distribute the guns to? for free.
To members of the militia attached to his own political party and the political party known as CDR. These party organizations have been in existence now for a couple of years. They grew up after human rights organizations began publicizing the fact that government officials were organizing massacres of Tutsi and opposition people. And this caused bad press for Habyarimana, and to avoid that, he created these militias so that it would be done by party people rather than by government people.
So he gave out guns to people for free, hoping that when he was ready for it, they would carry out massacres?
Not hoping, knowing.
Well, how do you organize something like that?
Well, you organize it by a 3-year campaign of propaganda over the radio, teaching people whom they should kill and whom they should hate. And then you take your local party cells and you find the people who most need money and power, and you give them that money and power, and then you pay a smaller amount to the ordinary worker, so to speak, and you train them militarily, as was done. Members of these militia were trained by the presidential guard, by soldiers, in how to kill. And then you get them primed for the right moment, and you provide the pretext and send them out.
And in this case, the pretext was?
The plane crash.
The death of the president.
The death of the president, right.
So everybody knew what they were supposed to do.
Within 10 minutes of the crash, the barricades were on the roads. Within an hour of the crash, killings had begun 60 kilometers away.
Now that the president is dead, who is the leader?
Well, these colonels whom I mentioned are officially in charge of the military forces. They put together a kind of rump government, a pretend government, that included some ministers who had previously served under Habyarimana. And that government supposedly is in their eyes, a legitimate government. But so far, it has not had too much success in being accepted as legitimate elsewhere in the world. Although I have to express serious concern here, because I know that representatives of this government, including the head of the political party that is responsible for the slaughtering of thousands of defenseless civilians, are today and were yesterday received by the government in France. And perhaps the French are going to move towards some form of acknowledgement or even recognition of these people.
You've mentioned radio propaganda campaigns. What were those campaigns?
Well, the national radio had been used since the start of the war with the RPF, that was October 1990, to identify what were called ibtizo, accomplices. And this meant anyone within Rwanda who was part of the political opposition or who was a person of the Tutsi group. These people were said to be accomplices of the foreign invaders, and that was a tune which began to be sung over the national radio in October 1990 and was carried through right up until the present time. When it became a little embarrassing for the national radio to carry this out in recent months, a private radio was established to take up and amplify this horrible song of hatred. And it included broadcasts such as, "The grave at such and such a site is only half full. Who can help us fill it up by 10 o'clock tonight?" That kind of thing. Clearly targeting anyone who had been a critic of President Habyarimana, including naming people by name, such as Monique Mujawa Maria, the human rights activist.
How did they name her?
They named her in connection with some popular songs that had the woman's name Monique in it. They would play these songs over the radio. And then the announcer would cut in and say, yes, we have a person named Monique in our country as well, but she's a little bit different from the person in the song. She's a traitor to our country. She's an evil person. She deserves to die the most horrible death, as do her children. And we're sure that that's going to happen to them one of these days.
Are there other friends in Rwanda who you've been trying to protect?
Yes, a number of people. Phone service was cut off about Oh, dear, time escapes me. I think it was maybe a week ago, maybe 10 days ago. The government cut the phones so that we would be unable to know the details of the massacres that were going on. Phone service was restored yesterday. Last night, during the night, I had a number of phone calls from people who are in desperate circumstances. One, a doctor who is had taken refuge in a hotel in Kigali. He's there with about 500 other people. They have been subject to repeated attack by government troops. They have been without food or water for 1 week. He is trying to help the wounded and to help women who are giving birth on the floor of the hotel without water. I've also received calls for help concerning 5,000 people who have been without food, imprisoned in a stadium in southwestern Rwanda in Cyangugu since April the 15th. I've received calls from families in Kigali who haven't had food for 9 or 10 days and ask me what to do with their children.
What are you telling the people who are calling you?
I tell them I'm doing what I can, and I try to encourage them to stay brave, and I try to describe all the things that we've been doing to try to move public opinion here and to try to get some action from our government and to get some reconsideration at the United Nations of their disgraceful vote to withdraw their peacekeeping force. I'm torn between lying promises and telling a truth which is absolutely full of despair, and sometimes I just don't know what to say.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Alison DeForges is a consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa. She's an assistant professor of history at the State University of New York at Buffalo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.